boys and girls. Here we are finally. After months and months and months, we are back for another episode of Campus, a novel that wants to be a musical. And I am the author of this crazy thing, whatever you want to call it. I like calling it a novel. A podcasted novel. And it's just my little way of getting a voice, because you know, I just don't feel like a lot of teachers, if you're a teacher and you're listening to me now, I know that you feel the same way a lot of times. We just don't have much of a voice nowadays, especially if you're teaching in the South, like me. If you've listened to any of this at all, then you know that this podcast novel, is about a very crazy, fantastical campus in Appalachia, where we have all kinds of gnomes and elves and vampires and humans. They're the scariest of all. And all sorts of creatures, Oboojums, which is kind of an Appalachian Sasquatch, and all of these things, including fairy god teachers. And this episode that we are going to listen to now is about one of those three fairy god teachers. And her name is Barbara McBride. And she is a math teacher. And I just love her so much. So I wanted to give her some backstory. And you say, well, I don't even know anything about what's going on. Huh? You got to go back and listen to all 13 of the other episodes. And then you will have an idea of what's going on. This one's kind of a standalone, but it includes some of the characters that we've already seen or heard about, excuse me. And so I think that you will enjoy this. I enjoy doing it. I do need to say one thing, and that is that there's no music in this novel. It wants to be a musical episode. Well, there's going to be some background music provided by Anchor, like I always give. But this time, I'm not a composer. I am not a musician. I'm not a composer. And I have tried to do music, and it's just not in me right now. I'm starting my last year of teaching, and I'm trying to go out, being the best teacher I can, even though nobody cares. So I'm trying to do this, and I forgot to turn the clock off. Too bad. I just got to get this episode out, so I'm not going to re-record this, and I'm not going to edit it very much, so you just have to live with the clock chiming because I forgot to turn it off. This helps me to stay sane because I can get out some of the frustration that I feel working, and it may not even be that bad. You know, that's the thing. It may not even be that bad. It may just be me, right? You know, this is the way people get sometimes when they're at the end of their career, you know? And even though they're, you know, everything's fine, and everything may be just fine. I mean, I had a good classes to start out the school year, and I really like my students, and I get along with my coworkers, most of them, and I'm trying to lay low and not be a big mouth, but I got to get it out somehow. So guess who gets to be the beneficiaries of it? You do, my loyal listener. I probably have at least one. I don't know. Maybe now it's been so long, I won't have any. But I'm going to try to build it back up. And we're going to do our best. And you're going to find out in this episode about Ms. McBride, a little bit more about her. You've only seen her a little bit in the novel so far. So, hang on to your seatbelts. It's going to be a great episode, even though it's not really going to have any music other than the background music provided by Anchor. Okay, here we go. I promise. Now.
Episode 14. Ms. McBride. Ms. McBride had not counted on being a teacher. Her love of numbers seemed to mean that she would be a PCA or an engineer. She certainly would have had a more lucrative career, But then, in school, she had fallen in love with a man who was born to be a teacher, who seemed at home in front of the classroom, her classroom. He was her philosophy professor, and when he spoke about Hegel or Kant, his brown eyes glittered with gold. She found it hard to concentrate on Kierkegaard when he tossed his tawny mane and ran his hands through it when frustrated, which he often was with her class. She was probably 10 years his junior, she thought, and she knew good and well that every female creature in the room was in love with him. But she would not show it. She would just find some way to be closer to him, that's all, to engage in intellectual conversation and let her brain win him over. She knew that fawning on him would only drive him away. He would not want a fairy girl. He would want a woman. There is something splendid about innocence, but what is bad about it in turn is that it cannot protect itself very well and is easily seduced. Kant said that. But Barbara McBride was a girl, a rather plain fairy girl, with unspectacular, rather moth-like brownish wings edged in solid black. He will not want me, she thought. She was as silly as all the others to imagine that he would ever think of her. Plus, she was a good girl and suspected, because he loved his job, knew that while he was her teacher, he would never even think of being interested in her. But she wouldn't always be a student, would she? But how to get him to notice her so that he would remember her? What was he saying? If you want to apply for a work-study position, we need some help in the philosophy department. That was it. When she went to the financial aid office to apply for the job right after class, there must have been 20 of her fellow classmates before her. They said it would be at least a week before she would hear about the job. But something happened, waiting in line there with all the others. Something began to change in her, and she wasn't worried at all. Because, you see, as methodical and calculated as she was, a seeming cold fish, her heart was an ember of fire, and now she knew was the time for it to burst into flame. After she filled out the application, she began to secretly read romance novels with half-naked men on the cover, holding close the young maidens, their breasts protruding from the too tight dresses. Historical romances she could justify just in case someone noticed. You can learn so much history from these books, she told her roommate one time before tossing the book aside. But it's so ridiculous. I can't read another page of it. Yes, Dr. Paul Temple, her philosophy professor, had unleashed a romantic, but she would never let anyone know and ruin her reputation. And yet, she dog-eared the steamiest pages, because it wasn't just romance she was after, you know. After all, she was a red-blooded American fairy. In the night, she would turn on her little pen light and read how the heroine, who of course hated the hero at the beginning because he was such a rogue, would have a fight with him, and then he would come to her in the night to admit he couldn't resist her charms, and she would give herself to him with abandon. Oh, so ridiculously lovely. And she would imagine the professor coming to her in her bed, whispering Kierkegaard into her ear. There are a you and an I. He would kiss her hand. And there is no mine and yours. His lips would travel up the soft skin under her arm. For without a you and an I, there is no love. He would tickle her neck with his scruffy beard. And with mine and yours, there is no love but mine and yours. His lips would press gently against hers. These possessive pronouns are, of course, formed from a you and an I. Harder, as his hands would travel to her. It was a week later, and they still had not announced her new position as Dr. Paul Temple's work study. She wasn't worried, but her mind was drifting a bit during his lectures these days. How shameful! His voice broke through her waking dream as he wound down his lecture reading from Kierkegaard's Works of Love. What was he saying? "And as a consequence, seem obliged to be present wherever there are a you and an I. This is indeed the case everywhere, but not in love, which is a revolution from the ground up. The more profound the revolution, the more completely the distinction mine and yours disappears, and the more perfect is the love." That's when her philosophy professor and strong elf with broad shoulders and tawny hair looked at her, this plain little fairy girl, and saw her for the first time. She got the job. The look had told her that she would. She was an aide to the department secretary, typing, filing, that sort of thing. She could type 65 words per minute on a good day when not distracted. But her dear Paul, how could he not distract her? He was everything she ever dreamed of in a man, and he was single and deep. He studied philosophy, after all, and once he got to know her and realized that she was his intellectual equal, well then... Now I really must interrupt this narration. I know I'm laying it on a bit thick here, but she really does think this way, I believe. As methodical and practical as she seems on the surface. "Mathematicians make good lovers," she once told me, "because we are so precise." Please. Anyway, her fingers flew along the keyboard unless Paul was in the room, and he would distract her, or they would distract her. They were the many female students who would visit during Paul's office hours asking for help. This seems a good time for a song. Paul in the work study. "I'm doing my work. I'm doing it well. I'm typing 60 words per minute or more, I can't tell. When she, beautiful, tall, and blonde, comes in and sits down, blonde, beautiful, and tall, I say, 'How can I help you?' And she wants to speak with Paul. 'Paul, I almost wish you were ugly. Paul, maybe then you would hug me. You're more good-looking than any man has a right to be. But there's more to you that they don't see. You're the man who's destined to love me, Paul.'" Then there was this time when the girls were all in a line, one after the other. They all had a need, and he talked to them right in front of me. I was angry at first. Didn't he know I had pages of work to do? I have no time for this. I can't stand the way they all dismiss me, because I'm not all that much to look at. Paul, I thought you might really like me. Paul, I thought you might be different. Different than the average one who might could see me for what I am. A woman with a high regard for Kierkegaard. Like you, Paul." In that semester, their friendship grew and grew, and so did her irritation with his constant flirtations with every female creature that came into his vicinity. It wasn't proper. It wasn't fair. It was mean. Then there was Jane. Jane was beautiful, of course. A wood elf, of course, like Paul. She had long red hair, athletic build. She was short, but different than most of the women who passed through the office. "Is Dr. Temple in?" she asked, startling Barbara. "Yes, he's in, but in a meeting." He told her to say that after the third student had left and he muttered something about needing to publish or perish. "I'll wait." And before Barbara could say anything, Jane had plopped down on the sofa. "He may be a while and his office hour is almost up." She didn't move. Barbara went back to her typing until she heard sniffles coming from the couch. Looking up, she saw that Jane was unsuccessfully trying to wipe her nose and eyes with her sleeve. Barbara didn't know what to say, so she just sat down on the couch next to Jane. Barbara handed her the tissues, and Jane began pulling at them, 1, 2, 3, 4, dabbing her eyes. Soon Jane began to speak between big intakes of breath. I just don't know what I will do. She sat up tall and then slumped again. My parents are gonna kill me. Barbara, being practical in all regards except when it came to men, said, "Oh, don't be silly." "Silly!" Jane stopped crying and Barbara saw a little fire in her eyes. "Well, I don't mean silly. I mean, that's probably an exaggeration." "You're right. But you don't know my parents. At the very least, they'll probably kick me out. I'd be better off dead." "Better off dead." Barbara then realized this situation was above her pay grade. She went to Paul's office door and knocked quietly. "What?" came the normally charming voice on the other side. "There's a student. Jane, she says her name is." There was a long pause. "Yeah?" "She's out there crying." "And?" "And I think she really needs your help." "Well, you can help her." Barbara opened the door. "Me?" He looked up from his word processor. "Yes, you. You're one of the brightest students I've ever had." Another pause. He smiled that smile of his. "And you're much, much nicer than me." She didn't know what to say. "Could you help a guy out? I really have to get this paper written so you can edit it for me and get it in the mail tomorrow." He turned his back on her and resumed pecking at the keys. He knew she would do anything for him. "Jane, Dr. Temple is working on an article for the Journal of Modern Mythical Creatures, and he can't help you right now, so I will help you. But I know it isn't the same, is it?" She started gathering the papers on her desk and looking sideways up at Jane, expecting her to decline the offer of help. But Jane surprised her. But can you? "Can I help you study your philosophy so you can pass the class and your parents won't kill you?" Jane nodded. I'm sure you can do that, but it's not that. It's if I can't help you, nobody can." Barbara unfurled her mothish wings, fluttering them vigorously for all the effect she could muster, something she had only recently had the guts to do. "You know what they say about fairy godpersons." She took a few books off the shelf, signed them out on the department loan sheet, while Jane just stood there, not saying a word. "But not here," said Barbara. "Let's go to the sub." She semi-flew out of the room, and Jane, looking back at Paul's closed door, followed her. The sub was the little snack bar down in the basement of the main classroom building. They served hamburgers, fries, corn dogs, nachos, that sort of thing. Horrible, greasy, overpriced, and one of everyone's favorite places to go on campus. Somehow, it felt somewhat normal there. Campus was in the middle of nowhere. Oh, wait, didn't I explain that Ms. McBride had received her associates at campus? Then went on to get her undergraduate degree in Asheville and her master's at Appalachian State. Her first and last job was here at campus. Drawn to it like a numerator to its denominator, you could say. And because of what happened with the wood elf, Jane. as the last employee of the sub was sweeping the floor right beside the booth where they sat and glancing in their direction. Barbara was in the middle of explaining Kant's categorical imperative. James seemed a bit confused, covering her pointy ears with her hands and shaking her head back and forth. "Okay, okay," said Barbara, wondering how anyone could be so obtuse. "Look at it this way. Every now and then, we all face situations where we don't really know what the right thing to do is. Right?" Jane looked at Barbara and blinked. "Daddy says if I will just do what he says, I never have to worry about making any heavy-duty decisions like that." "Oh, is that right?" Barbara sipped on her cherry Slurpee and thought of another way to say it. "Let's see here. Suppose your father dies." "What?" "God forbid that would ever happen, but inevitably he will. We all do. So say that he dies. Suddenly, tragically. Perhaps I should move on. When he was alive, he would tell you what to think and how to behave. But now, how do you know how to do the right thing?" Jane still looked confused. "Not sure what this has to do with my philosophy class or with anything." Barbara leaned across the booth. "The categorical imperative." "The categorical imperative?" "Yes, for those times when there is no one telling us what to think and how to feel. When doing the right thing is not so obvious to us." "Okay. To Kant, the question of moral ambiguity was answered by the categorical imperative." Jane's beautiful face was still blank, so Barbara moved on. "Which is the idea that all morality is based on. There are several different versions. One runs like this. Quote, act only on the maxim that you can. Will as a universal law. What this means basically is that we should only ask ourselves, how would it be if everyone acted the way I'm acting? Could I sincerely and consistently wish for a world in which everyone behaved this way? According to Kant, if our action is morally wrong, the answers to those questions would be no. For instance, think of this. Suppose I'm thinking of breaking a promise." Jane didn't say anything. "Could I wish for a world in which everyone broke their promises when keeping them was inconvenient?" Jane shifted in her seat. "Kant argues that I could not want this, not least because in such a world, no one would make promises, since everyone would know that a promise meant nothing." The sweeper, now a very irritated fairy who was tired and wanted to go home to study his script, he was in the theater department, cleared his throat and said, "Barbara, I don't think she can learn everything about 18th century philosophy in one night." He sidled up to Jane, who was very pretty, reached for her hand and kissed it. "Hello," he said in his Shakespearean trained voice. "My name is Brian Teasdale." He released her hand. "Care to take a break from studying?" Jane blushed prettily and nodded. "But we haven't covered everything on the test." "That's okay, Barbara." She stood still looking into Brian's eyes. "I'll study some more tomorrow." "But what about your parents?" Jane looked at Brian. "You have to close up, don't you?" He nodded. "I'll wait for you outside, okay?" Brian picked up the broom and left. Jane sat down in the booth. "I appreciate all your help, Barbara. You're so smart and know so much. My brain is so full. It's as full as it's going to get tonight. But maybe we can meet again tomorrow." I don't know. I might be busy. Oh, if you're busy, then... Her voice trailed off and she got up. Thanks for everything. She started to leave, but Barbara stopped her. You know, I think I will be here studying for that test tomorrow. Down here in the sub if you want to join me. I'd like that. Thanks. Then she was gone. Barbara never saw Jane again. But soon after that incident, Brian Teasdale, that young fairy who worked in the sub, told Barbara that he had gone out with the pretty elf. Of course he did. According to him, under the influence of his considerable charm, Jane had revealed that she was pregnant. And guess who was the father? Barbara didn't want to believe gossip like that, but was forced to consider the reality when Dr. Paul Temple suddenly resigned from campus and moved to a one-room cabin in Morton, Minnesota to study the small band of wood elves called Kenoti, who lived on the banks of Sulphur Lake right outside of town. He was, the rumors claimed, doing extensive research for his next book, It's All Good, The Embrace of Amor Fati Among the Dwindling Elvish Population of the Midwestern United States. Sure to be a bestseller, it was said, among elvish philosophers of all stripes. Barbara's disappointment in the dangerously fickle Dr. Temple was short-lived thanks to Brian Teasdale, who became a lifelong friend and colleague. His quirky sense of humor and sense of fun, as well as his extraordinary matchmaking abilities, were unparalleled in the mythical world. After all, it was Brian Teasdale who introduced her to her dear Mr. McBride. But that is a story for another day.